Harambe, Harambe, Harambe.
Working together for progress.
Feel the oneness of Harambe.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Alafia Harambe listeners, you are live at the 9 o'clock hour with your host, Baye Kemet, with the show, The Liberated Zone. And The Liberated Zone is a space for African people to articulate their paradigms of practice, their ideologies, and also their theories on African-centered education and on any topic that we find relevant to the liberation and the salvation and the sovereignty of African people. Tonight, my guest, Baba Sanyika Anwije, is no stranger to this show. He was on our show back in May, I believe, and he is back today, and I want to welcome him to be on the show.
Oh, Madase, Asante Sana. Asante.
That's a key too. All right.
To hear your voice, and greetings, Hamdambo, to all of our listeners, our brothers and sisters listening to Harambe Radio. We'd like to, again, thank the Creator for the health and strength to be here this evening. I'd like to thank our ancestors for providing us with shoulders upon which to stand to continue their work in the liberation of African people.
Ashe. All right, before we begin, there's a few announcements that I have to make. First of all, I want to thank everyone who has assisted our school, the Garvey School, and Egun Omode Shule in our fundraising campaign that we have going on now, which is called Save a School, Save a Nation. And we are in the process of purchasing a building, and we have been receiving donations from afar and local, and people have been sending in, you know, all amounts, $5, $20, $50, $100. And we just want to thank everyone who has been very supportive of our efforts so far. And again, if you want to learn more about what we are doing at our Shule, you can go to www.thegarveyschool.org. That is T-H-E, garveyschool.org. And you can make a donation. You can also read about what we're doing at our institution. We are located here in Trenton, New Jersey. And in this fall, we will be embarking upon adding some grades to our Shule. We will be opening a daycare starting at the age of 1 year old up to 2.5. And then, of course, our preschool, which we already have in place, will begin at 2.5 or potty train and up to, I guess preschool and pre-K, and then we go elementary and middle, and we do have a high school, but for those who have been inquiring, we are no longer accepting students directly into our high school or into our middle school. That we actually adopted the policy that we're no longer accepting students after the fifth grade. And Baba, in fact, I recall, now that I'm on this subject, I recall having this dialogue with you when you and I, along with, believe, Mama Riquette, who is co-facilitator of the Council of Independent Black Institutions, along with myself, her husband, Baba Nora, and Baba Kofi Lomote, who's president of Southern University at Baton Rouge, all members of CB, when we were in Minnesota, I recall you explaining to us your admission policy or facets of your admission policy at Hofi Nkwenu Academy, Frederick Douglass Institute. And so, and this is a perfect segue into our discussion tonight. And if you will, Baba, again, just give the listening audience a brief, you know, I guess, description of who you are, your family, and the institution that you all run and the activities that you all have going on in St. Louis. And at the end of that, if you can add on to this whole notion of why you all do not accept students after a certain grade, or just speak to your admissions policy, if you will, Baba.
Indeed, Asante, Asante. And I'm Jambo, of course, to our CB brothers and sisters, the various brothers and sisters and institutions and villages that are members of CB. Also to the various Majima, or families that are associated with and are members of New African Village, Hofi Nkwenu Academy, Douglas Institute here in St. Louis, and to my own biological family, the Amwishes, Hamjambo, to all of you. The New African Village is a developing land-based effort aimed at demonstrating on a small scale the components of self-reliance, those being our ability as a people to feed, house, clothe, educate, medicate, and defend ourselves on the road to sovereignty as a people. We have no illusions that we are alone in this effort, because there are many, and we hope an increasing number of brothers and sisters, actually globally, who understand that there's a difference between freedom and more comfort on the plantation.
Gotcha.
There's a difference between freedom and pseudo-freedom. And the freedom is defined by all people in history and all people currently who have received a proper, if you will, political cultural education, is defined as the point at which a people can decide for themselves what is in our best interest, and in addition to that, have the power or the ability to bring those decisions into fruition. This is also known as self-determination or sovereignty. And one of the key components to self-determination, one of the key components to sovereignty, is, again, self-reliance, collective group self-reliance. And that's because if a people are dependent on those outside of their society, outside of their nation, their race, their group, for the basic things that give and bring and sustain life, in other words, the ability to feed, house, clothe, educate, medicate, and defend ourselves as a people. If we're dependent on others for that, then we are also subject to their manipulation, their dictation, and their control. We are, in fact, not free. You can check that out on an individual level. Ask yourself. I'm not speaking to just you're speaking to us all. On an individual level, on a family level, if you're dependent on that person next door to feed you, that person next door, in fact, controls you or has the potential to control you. If you're dependent on them for housing, shelter, and so forth down the line in each of those areas, then those people control you. They can dictate what you do, how you do it, when you do it.
That's right.
And this is, you know, this ability to be self-reliant is one of the key components, not the only component, but the, one of the key components to freedom. One of the other components is our social relationships, how we relate to each other, whether we are able to live in unity and in peace, resolve our and manage our conflicts and our disagreements, is another key component. And last but certainly not least is the way that we relate to the Creator. There's an African proverb that says that anything of substance, anything of importance, starts with, begins with, and is guided by the Creator. And there are various names, of course, for the Creator across the continent. But the idea is still the same. And so it's within New African Village that we attempt to show all of these things on a small level with a limited number of persons. And this is in order to, how should we say, begin to practice for the time that we as a people return to righteous living and sovereignty, and also to give a physical demonstration, if you will, to brothers and sisters in order to convince us, persuade us, if you will, that sovereignty, as opposed to assimilation or more comfort on the plantation, is the road to freedom, and it's self-reliance, African-based social relationships, and a life lived through the guidance of the Creator and with the guidance of the ancestors is the God-ordained and best way for us as a people to live. Now, in our first step in that, actually way before we were actually called New African Village, our first step in this process was the institution of the education component. And that started off as an elementary school where we went through fourth grade. And just as you were remarking about Garvey Shule and Egon Omode Shule there in Trenton,
right,
we began adding on new grades as we were able to. We started off adding one grade per year, and we eventually capped off at eighth grade, and we plateaued there for a few years, and then in 1996 opened a high school component, the Hofe Nkweno Academy.
Right.
The academy and the institute, Douglas Institute, exists today and are vital components of New African Village. And again, the purpose of those institutions is not just to teach us how to read, write, and do arithmetic, not just to teach us the basic academics, nor to teach us to be job or entrepreneurial ready, not to keep us out of trouble, nor necessarily even to teach us to be proud of our history. We do indeed teach and want to see all of that, but that alone is insufficient to produce the workers and the warriors, if you will, that have a mindset to move us, to help to move us as a people back toward righteous living and sovereignty. Again, not just simply having a job or having a business or being proud of our heritage just for the sake of it and still remaining as, if you will, captives of the non-African, captives of the European.
That's right.
Now, the admission process you asked about has gone through quite an evolution, quite a development over the years. And that's something I think that, you know, from our discussions, years in mind, that we know is something that institutions have to do. You have to grow as you go. You have to make adjustments. And one of the things that we found out with the admissions policy was that from the very first was that families needed to make a statement as to why it is that they wanted to be enrolled. Again, if they were just coming to have their children get an academic education and get academically astute, that was insufficient.
Right.
If they were just
right.
coming because their children were having trouble sitting still and being well-disciplined, and they wanted us to work on their children so their children would be better behaved, yeah, we do that, but that alone is insufficient. If they were looking for a place to come and get, if you will, dipped in black culture and learn about the names and dates and faces and places of African history, black history, we do that, but that alone is insufficient. And so we wanted people to at least tell us why it is that they wanted their children to be enrolled and tell us a little bit about their child. It's an application. Wherever you go, you need an application. One of the major evolutions in that enrollment process was an orientation session. We used to sit, when we first started, with parents for maybe an hour, hour and a half, and talk with families one-on-one. And as enrollment began to grow, we found that we were really wearing ourselves out talking with prospective parents individually for an hour and a half. And so we moved to an orientation session, which today lasts for a full day from 9 to 5 or 10 to 6, generally on a Saturday, once or twice a year. And we go over that required, that mandatory orientation session, and we discuss the philosophy, methodology, ideology, as many details as we can within that, within those hours, about what it is and why we exist. From there, families, the adults at least, they agree to and are required to go through a class, the first class, a class per year. And the first class is called Education is More Than the Three R's. And that course basically talks about the methods and gives an analysis of educating the African child. We talk about, of course, increasing intellectual capacity, grades, and skill acquisition. We also talk about the media, the popular culture, and how to create, a home program that helps to mitigate the effects of the media and popular culture, because we know that that culture is one of the primary weapons, if you will. It's not just a tool, it's a weapon that is used by the dominant society here, the Europeans, globally actually, to miseducate, if you will, young and old alike. We talk about creating a non-adversarial adult-child relationship, back to understanding the part of the African personality is good self-discipline. And too many of our children in the Pan-African community, and I'm kind of jumping ahead of myself, but one of the things I did notice in the 1970s, and which is beginning to change a little bit now, not solely because of our efforts, but I do believe that we have been very faithful in teaching and preaching about this, is our children were way out of control in the 1970s. Not all of our children, but it was so many of the children in the Pan-African community were being raised not according to African standards, but more according to what we would call European hippie standards. Very permissive, very out of control, talking back to their parents, calling their parents by their first names and that kind of thing. Just really not doing what they were told. And many institutions and CB as a whole has definitely grown in this respect. And this is one of the things that we do teach in our class. Education is more than the three R's. We also teach in that class preparing children to respect the other gender and to become marriage partners and parents. This is another thing I think that has that is at least growing in the Pan-African community, and that's the idea that there's a need for family, definitely family, and family begins with the marriage of a man and a woman, an African man and an African woman. Shacking up is not, is frowned upon, it's not condoned in our institution. We tell our children and we tell our families, and our families agree and promote this, that we have love and commitment, then marriage, then sex, then children, in that order. And this is something that we're glad to see is growing in the Pan-African community and within true African education, and understanding that the African family is the basis for the nation, and it is the basis of all spiritual, cultural, and political growth. There is no nation building without family building. We talk about those are some of the major things that we talk about in that course. And the family building actually is the springboard to our next course. Our next course is called Relationships, Love, Like, or Lust, where we talk about building strong marriages, mate selection, all the things that are necessary in the development of a good family, a good home. And then there are other courses that we have after that. These are courses for our adults, because we believe that education, true African education, is womb to the tomb. It doesn't start at age 4 or age 5.
Right.
It starts prenatally and proceeds through various stages in life. Even elders, the wise, are responsible for continued growth and development. So it's constant, that there's a constancy of study that we try to facilitate and make available within the village. One of the things that we do have in common there, and we did talk about that part of the enrollment there where we don't admit students generally after the fourth or fifth grade. They can go all the way through the 12th grade, and hopefully, of course, they will remain as members of the village for a lifetime. But in terms of the day-to-day schooling or educational process within the school institutions, they do have to be with us by fourth or fifth grade. And the reason for that is because despite all of what we have said, despite the various cautions and the various advisories that we have about what it is that we are about, that the fact that this is not just a school, this is part of a movement to facilitate or to help facilitate our people's return to righteous living and sovereignty, there are still families who will attempt to take advantage of the process and bring their children in at 7th, 8th, 9th grade, many times having known about this process when those children were 3 and 4 and 5 years of age, but decided not to put their children in the school, trying to try the European educational system, the European miseducational system first. And when it failed and their children have become burdensome, they then look to our institution to save them, and that is not fair. Although we used to do it, but we have to, along with my wife and I, we are too old and wise to do that anymore. We don't have the energy to do that kind of thing anymore. And we just advise people to bring them while they are young and they are pliable, they're moldable. There's an African proverb that says, as you bring your child up, so it will grow up. As the twig is bent, so will the tree grow. You can't bend a tree. You can't bend a tree. You bend a twig. You mold a twig. You work with youth while they are young in the critical period of their lives, while we can still work with them without having to break them, so to speak. Now, don't get us wrong. You bring a 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old in, they will do what they are told. We're clear on that. They will do what they are told, but it takes more energy at that time, and sometimes takes the energy that we would be using with these younger children, takes away the energy that we've been using with the younger children to deal with some of their behavioral issues. But you have to still be clear that if they did come, they would still be in line, so to speak, or be in circle, rather, from an African perspective. So I hope we've answered that question about some of the generalities of the enrollment process.
Most certainly, Baba. I greatly appreciate all of your wisdom and information, knowledge, and expertise and experience on the subject matter. I think those who are listening can get an understanding of the depth and the array of, just different experiences that you have to use in order to effectively, facilitate an African-centered school or any school for that matter. And I'm laughing when you said that there are certain things that you all used to do that you don't do anymore, because over time, we all begin to grow and understand and look at things, and when we want to fine tune it and tweak it so that it works best for the child and for our institution. I think I'm not gonna speak for you all, but I know for us at the Garvey School that we were doing some things trying to more so help the child and the family, or try to say help them out, and trying to, take on a student coming from, let's say, Trenton Public School, who had just gotten kicked out of that school, and from getting kicked out of another school, here we are trying to shape them up and get them ready for the real world, that kind of thing, within a year or two. And then we just looked at it over the time and realized that it was just really unrealistic for us that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I appreciate and I ask for you to speak on the admissions policy, because I mean, there are so many aspects of running an African school or an IBI that people don't actually look at. I think that some people come into this situation financially minded. I know a lot of people who approach me about opening a school are really looking at it from a financial perspective, how much money they can get per, you know, for their salary coming from a public school perspective. You know, how much should they set their tuition? It's almost as if they're coming in as a business.
Mm-hmm.
And there's others who come with an academic approach, but the approach is, you know, a European public school model that they're trying to throw a red, black, and green stroke over.
Mm-hmm.
And so we find various forms of people coming in wanting to do an African Center school, but they're not really studying or the information from, I would say, you know, the Council of Independent Black Institutions perspective. Not saying as though our information is the end-all, be-all, and I think I said that maybe 2 months ago on the show that you were on before, but that the experience that many of our institutions have and many of the things that we've gone through and many things that we have learned are things that many people who are trying to, you know, open schools should learn from. And this is information that we all can share together grow. And so, again, I'm saying all to say that I appreciate your response to the question, and at this time we have to take a break. We're at the midway point.
Right.
And so I'm going to ask my listeners to return with us after the break. We're live with the Liberated Zone with your host, Baye Kemet. My guest today is Baba Sanyika Onwuije, and we look forward to continuous discussion on the second part of the show.
Greetings, Harambe family. This is Samut A. Scott of Magical Mother. I'd like to introduce you to some friends of mine. Equity Source Home Loans, located right here in the North Brunswick, New Jersey area, have been servicing clients for more than 20 years. The office has hours Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and the products they offer are conventional, FHA, VA, reverse mortgage, and assistance with investment and commercial property needs. Their number is 732-821-2110. And tell them Magical Mother sent you.
Hey, mark your calendar so that you can join Harambe Radio and Television's very own Delani Aman, Wallace Durham, and Hamza Sid Catlett Bey at the 30th annual Black August weekend event featuring the 7th annual Happily Natural Day, August 14th through 16th in Atlanta, with guests Afia Ibomu, Daruba Ben Wahad, welfare poets, Professor Griff, Walimu Baruti, the Aya Likes, Mukasa Dada, Oyabore Abigunde, Julie Dexter, plus many more still to come. Go to www.happilynaturalday.com for more information. That's happily, H-A-P-P-I-L-Y, natural, N-A-T-U-R-A-L, day, D-A-Y.com. We'll see you there.
Peace and love.
This is Delani Aman thanking you for listening to Harambe Radio. Harambe, Harambe, Harambe.
Working together for progress.
Feel the oneness of Harambe.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Hello, for your Harambe listeners. You are back live with the 9 o'clock hour, the Liberated Zone, with your guest, with your host, Baye Kemet. I'm a guest tonight. My guest, Baba Sanyika, is doing such a wonderful job of hosting the show, of giving us information and knowledge and wisdom and understanding, you know, from an elder perspective, that, you know, I just, you know, I'm humbled and happy to have him on our show. And again, I want to welcome him back to our show in the second half of the show, Baba Sanyika.
All right. Well, thank you. Asante. Asante.
All right. Kitu. All right, so, you know, I want to further the discussion on African-centered education and you know, and African culture and where we are as a people today. And I want you to talk a little bit about, you know, the history, I guess, over the last maybe 20 or 30 years coming from out of the 70s into the 80s, through the 90s, and now the 2000s, of how, you know, I guess the school environment has evolved, you know, how communities have evolved and what have you. And I'm asking the question because I can recall growing up in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, well, early 70s, mid-70s, but really going to school in the mid to late 70s. And I can recall, especially in the 80s, early 80s, when we were in school, children were disciplined. I mean, a lot of times that stuff happened right there in class. I'm talking public school. You know, teachers were able to, you know, pop a child in the class, you know, especially if the mother gave him or her the permission. You know, children knew if your parents gave the teacher the permission to pop them, the children generally did not act up in school. You know, and of course, over time, we know those things have changed and what have you. I also can recall being in school and, you know, there was only like maybe one or two children that were, you know, troublemakers in class, or those who were less disciplined than others, or whose work ethic wasn't as, you know, up to par as other students. And I can recall they either sat to the left or they sat to the right or they sat up to the front right next to the teacher or they sat in the back. But it wasn't this whole notion of today where you have the entire class that is just in disarray and you may have one or two children that's in the classroom trying to learn. And I mean, there's a lot of, you know, social issues that we can look to. I know one major issue that I personally can recall happening in the mid-80s was the onslaught of crack cocaine. Mm-hmm. And I can remember not only families and communities decimated, but I can remember my friends, 12, 13, 14 years old, some even earlier than that, that were leaving school, going on, you know what I mean, the blocks of my neighborhood selling crack, mm-hmm. you know, because this was a viable option for them now to bring food and clothes into their household where they didn't have these things. Mm-hmm. And so school became less of a priority. You can also look at hip-hop music. When hip-hop made its infusion, there's been studies done that the reading levels of children have gone down because more children are now trying to rap versus trying to read and all those kind of things. So, not to belabor the point, Baba, I just want you to speak a little bit to, you know, what your memories were of I guess, even the 70s or even further back, you know, to how schools were, how classrooms were, and then what has happened over the time period.
Well, I think that you actually have covered that pretty well in terms of the general shift and some of the factors that were involved in that. And I'll try to respond to the question, respond to the subject like this. My parents told me that if they come to school and they see the whole class cutting up and there's only one child doing what is correct, I better be that child.
Right.
And so I say that to say that so much of it starts at home. It starts with a family who places a premium on correct, righteous behavior. Now, that doesn't mean the child is going to toe that line or remain in that circle all the time. And that's where we have to understand that a child is raised by his or her village, another African proverb. We have, as a people, from a cultural, political perspective, and I have no love for the miseducation that came through schools of Shulani even before desegregation or before integration. I have great respect for the black men and the black women who were the teachers and administrators who struggled and worked to provide us with what they felt was, or what they had been taught was, the best education, the best environment possible. And out of that came many, 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 many academically educated brothers and sisters, men and women, who are now elders and many who have made their transition. Out of that came many, many brothers and sisters, men and women, who are now elders, who lived righteously and attempted to raise their families when they became grown righteously. When we, though, gave our babies over to Europeans to be schooled, when we insisted segregation. And either white people or black people who have been trained directly by white people to teach our children, we have to list that as one of the most critical missteps we have made as a people. One of the most critical missteps we have made as a people. My mother, for example, didn't get into the classroom. She was trained as a teacher, but she waited until pretty much all of us were in high school and up out of the house, so to speak, before she actually took a job. And back at that time, when she first graduated from back in the 1920s from teacher college, women couldn't be teachers or be employed as teachers in the St. Louis Public School anyway if they were married. And so she decided she was going to be married and be a mother. And so that was her priority, and we appreciate that. But she got in, and when she began teaching, she had a green thumb, so to speak, as a classroom teacher. Her students scored the highest on all of the tests. It didn't matter what the test was, district-wide tests. Her students were scoring district-wide, as a matter of record, higher than other classrooms consistently, year after year after year after year. When desegregation came, they took her and other talented teachers, black teachers like her, and sent her and them to South St. Louis to teach white children, and brought undisciplined white teachers north to teach black children, which in itself you can see there's a problem there.
That's right.
And so along with their inexperience and misdirection as teachers, they also brought with them, and this is not just in St. Louis, this is all over. There's a version of this in almost everywhere. They brought with them teaching methodologies which were foreign to and antipathetic to the best interest of the growth of black children. They came with permissiveness. Oh, I'm not Mrs. Jones, just call me Jane. That's not how we relate. Oh, do you want to go pick this up? Do you want to go do that? This was homicide, if you will, educational, developmental homicide to our children. And it wasn't just them. See, there were many of us who went off to college, and we went to get our bachelor's and our master's and some EdD and PhD degrees, and we thought we knew better than our ancestors knew about how to raise and discipline and educate our children. And we brought these foreign teaching methodologies and child-rearing theories into our homes and into our daycare centers and into our churches and into the schools where black children were. And we have ruined a generation of children. Now, I'm not saying this is the only factor, but I'm saying this is a major factor in what we have witnessed. We believe in hugging children. We believe in complimenting children. We believe in nurturing children as African people. But we also believe that if you can't get the message in your ear, then we need to address some other part of your anatomy until you hear. And this is, of course, you know, referring to spanking. And we, in our progressive thinking, and many of us in the nationalist community said, oh, well, you know, spanking is, you know, that's the white man's thing. This is something that has resulted from or came down through enslavement. No, that's historically inaccurate.
Right.
We as a people have loved our children, and part of that love included making sure that they did what they were supposed to do for the community, for their families, when they were supposed to do it, not when they got ready to. This is why we have so many self-centered children, because we have brought them a child-centered curriculum. There was a child-centered classroom, a child-centered curriculum. The African concept is we are people, village-centered, community-centered. We're not centered on just one group or another. And so
right.
if you center it around the child, then you shouldn't be surprised the children grow up to be self-centered. If
right.
you tell a child 5-6 times to go do something, and they don't do it until they get ready, or you use some kind of trickery or bribery to get them to do it, then they're going to grow up in all of their relationships, including their male-female relationships, with their future husbands, with their future wives, not doing a thing until they get ready to do it. And I think many of the brothers and sisters out there in relationships, in marriages, in organizations, can testify to the fact there are people who just don't do things when the organization or the family or the spouse needs them to do it. But they do it only when they get ready to. And this is largely a result of the permissive and dangerous methods of child rearing that we have instituted or allowed to come into our community. So, you know, the black people, we as the people in our schools were some of the ones who were the first to protest against African forms of child rearing and child rearing methodology. And when we look at the children in the schools, we have that European or the non-African child rearing methodology and educational philosophy. We have that to blame. So those are some of the kinds of things that I see or saw that were different then than now. But I think that we should not miss the major point, though, is that although there was maybe a greater sense of decorum, the reality is that we were still headed toward a point of chaos. Although it may have looked a little bit more organized
right.
chaos, if you will. Anytime you're still on the plantation, anytime you are not moving toward, we're not moving toward the sovereignty of our people, but rather toward assimilation with the non-African, it's going to result in chaos, whether it's organized chaos, safe chaos, or type of chaos that you were describing earlier. It's still chaos nonetheless. And so this, again, is not to say not to criticize our brothers and sisters at all. It's just that we as a people have been under assault for so long, under colonialism, enslavement, and our socialization process has been obfuscated by that colonization, miseducation, enslavement process. And so we are at a point of actually growing out of that. We are at a point of rediscovering who we are, how we were, and how we should be. So it's a process that we have to be patient with ourselves, but at the same time be open to learning and growth and move with all deliberate speed forward or back toward righteous living and sovereignty.
All right. I greatly appreciate that, Baba. So, you know, you mentioned a few times this this notion of being on the plantation.
Mm-hmm.
I have this discussion quite often with people who do not understand and do not see that where they are right now is a plantation. And they, you know, oftentimes I hear people make this, you know, argue the notion that we as black people have to somehow, you know, work for white people because we're not in a all, you know, black world and so forth and so on. Of course, I have my own argument for that. But I want to, you know, twist that notion and ask the question in relation to education. People question why we have African-centered schools, you know, and because, you know, of course, the whole world is not black and, you know, they have to learn about white people's culture and all these other kind of things, and they have to get along with white people in order to survive in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I have my own response to that, but can you please speak to this notion of the necessity of African-centered schools in relation to our children being quote-unquote successful? And I say quote-unquote unsuccessful because when most people think of success, they're talking about their children graduating from college and then going off and getting a well-paid job, regardless of who they're working for, regardless of how they're parlaying their intellectual and physical wealth to someone else's, you know, financial stability. But that's how they define success. So I'm gonna say it all again. That can you please speak to this whole notion of the necessity of African-centered education, you know, in response to people who are concerned with their children having to have a what they call diversified education?
Hmm. Well, the response is that if we don't teach our children what they need to have to grow to be the workers and warriors to advance our people toward freedom, and we define freedom as sovereignty, not assimilation. If we don't teach our children that, no one else will. And that teaching is done through Shulaney, of course, like ours. C.B. Shulaney. It's done through the home. It's done through those Shulaney. It's done through our spiritual institutions, if you will. It's done through casual, impromptu, unplanned conversations and interactions. But the core of it comes out of the home and the school. And again, if we don't teach our children that, and we don't build institutions that teach them that, then they will be subject to the miseducation of the institutions of the non-Africans. And those institutions, starting with the United States flag or the French flag or the British flag or wherever you find our children going to school, starting with that flag outside, to their Pledge of Allegiance to start the day, to their nation, to their culture, to their agenda of imperialism and further neocolonialism, to how they teach our children to act and interact and react to each other. All of that, they will be subject to miseducation and will be driven toward, guided toward, led toward greater service to those colonial masters, the neo-imperialists, to the European non-African the survival of that culture as opposed to ours. That's why we have to have our own education, and our own education has to be full-time. It has to be 24/7. We can't expect our children to go away to these institutions and then come back black to us. The purpose of those institutions is to create a sense of allegiance, respect, responsibility, and accountability to those non-Africans. If we want our children to have a sense of allegiance, respect, responsibility, and accountability to us, we have to provide that education. We have to provide the institutions, the places, and the environments for that to occur. We are still struggling as a people with the dual path to survival and what some of us consider to be thrival. And it's not a new question. It's not a new debate. From the time that, figuratively, that we got off the boats here, or were taken off the boats here, there were two schools of thought. Do we try to get along and assimilate with these people and become like them and become accepted by them? Or the other school of thought is, do we try to return home spiritually, mentally, and physically? Do we try to continue to be Africans and continue to be who God called us to be? And that has been the question that we've grappled with for several centuries. And for those of us who believe that our mission is to return home spiritually, mentally, and physically, not necessarily this generation, it's the work of generations, provide the education that will develop us and strengthen us so that return is possible.
Okay, all right. Baba, we have about 5 minutes left in the show. Please, give your contact information to the listeners so they can, get in contact with you in the St. Louis area. If any families are interested or any information you want the listeners to know, can you please give that to them at this point?
Yes, we would like, for those interested, and we'd like to talk to brothers and sisters globally, and we can be reached at area code 314-382-0720. We can also be reached toll-free at 1-888-BLESS-75. And the digits that correspond to that are 1-888-253-7775. Your last question reminded me of a brief conversation I had with a sister a couple of weeks ago. She was visiting from out of town, and she talked about the need for African World Revolution and us as a people becoming free. And she asked about the educational process. And she says, that's nice, but I'm just interested in the children learning how to read, write, and do arithmetic. And if they learn how to read, they'll be able to figure out the rest of this. And when we as a people get free, then we can institute curricula like the one that you're speaking of. And so I had to ask her, well, how do you propose that we will create or develop the number of people to build the nation, to do, as she calls it, the revolutionary things, the critical mass of people to make that possible? She didn't have an answer for that. She said, I really don't know. I guess we just have to continue to have rap sessions and talk and discuss. I said, that's the reason that we have African institutions, to create those workers and those warriors who will become the critical mass, who will bring about the rebuilt nation, who will bring about that revolution that you talk about, who will build the institutions and rebuild our nationhood as a people. And without that educational process to develop the values, the mores, the worldview, and the commitment, the stick-to-itiveness that's necessary for that kind of struggle, for that kind of sustained work, generation after generation, without that type of education, we are lost as a people.
Ashe. All right. Mm-hmm. All right. Harambe listeners, you are listening to Baba Sahika on Weeje here on the Liberated Zone. I want to, before I leave, I want to give a shout out to Baba Kofi Lomote in
Baton Rouge.
Harambe listeners, I think the man's trying to cut my wisdom. All right, but again, before we end, I just want to say that all of the Council of Independent Black Institution members, we want to give a shout out to all of them. Again, I want to thank my guest Baba Sahika Anweje for coming on tonight. And again, next week we will have Mama Makini out of a nation house, Washington, D.C., on our show. And, you know, we want to balance what we do here on the show and have women, have men, so that we can represent African complementarity, we can represent balance, we can represent Ma'at, all right, as we are doing this show. So, again, all of the people who are listening, I know my wife Makita is listening. I know Yatanisha is definitely listening because we had Baba Saika on. And, you know, so for all the people who listen every week, you know, Akanke, Safia, all the people who are listening, again, I want to say thank you, and I will speak with you all next week on the Liberated Zone at 9 o'clock hour.